Blog Talk Radio.
To an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here so much to tell you about the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future and to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that will occur in your life, in your world, the one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. Doing good.
All right. Well, we got a big, big show tonight. So I'll tell you what we're going to do is we're going to cut out all the preliminaries, and we're just going to bring out our guest. I'd like to introduce him. He's a best-selling author, an American-Hungarian, and he began a solo multi-year sailing journey around the world at the age of 21. His main cargo was 500 hand-picked books, mostly classics. He's explored over 100 countries, many as a journalist for the National Geographic Channel, writing, filming, and appearing in dozens of television stories, articles, and webcasts. His work has been featured by the New York Times Syndicate, Outside, San Francisco Chronicle, BBC Radio, NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, Animal Planet, and the Travel Channel. He is a philosophy and religious studies graduate of Columbia University and resides in San Francisco with his daughter and physician wife. He also blogs for Psychology Today and the Huffington Post, and he is one of 99 authors of the upcoming The World Transformed, the abridged edition. Zoltán István, welcome to The World Transformed.
Oh, well, hey, thank you so much, gentlemen, Stephen and Phil. I very much appreciate you having me on the show.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. We're excited to get into talking about the transhumanist wager. Before we do, I want to talk briefly about the book I just mentioned, which is our 99-chapter abridged edition of the larger e-book version of The World Transformed. It's the world's longest book, the book we're putting together to encourage everyone to think about what kinds of ideas they can come up with to transform the world. And, Stephen, I got a quick update for you. I believe the goal that you set for me back in September was for us to have all 99 slots filled by the end of October. And as of last week,
were
just a little bit shy, but I'm pleased to announce tonight that the flight is fully booked. And in fact, we are going to overbook the flight just slightly because some of those seats that are reserved are for people that we don't know directly, we've never had on the show, and we're not sure if they're going to come back, so we're going to go ahead and let some other people who know that someone else may be ahead of them in the queue sign up as well. So when all said and done, we might have 105, 110 people ready to go, but we've got our core, we've got our 99, and I won't read the whole list because we have a whole show to do here tonight, and it would take too long. But I just want to mention three names of people who've signed up in the past week or so, Zoltán being one. And Zoltán, we're thrilled that you're going to be participating in the project.
Thank you.
And Amara D'Angelica, Stephen, you know her from Kurzweil AI, one of the lead bloggers.
That's right.
Over there. Probably does 60%, 70% of the blogging over there. And then a name, I don't know if you're going to recognize this name, Chris Tackland. Do you know who that individual is?
No, I do not.
Zoltán, any idea who that is?
No, I actually don't.
Okay, Chris Tackland is the inventor of the inkjet printer. So,
oh, wow.
Okay. That's interesting. Okay.
So I think that's pretty cool. Talk about an individual who has already made a world-transforming contribution to the world, huh?
Absolutely.
Looking forward to seeing what he comes up with. He and 98 others. Anyway, it's very exciting to see the project coming together. And for those of you who are participants in this abridged edition, early stage of the project, let me just tell you that I'm working on getting a site up on worldtransform.org, which will enable you to submit your chapter. It will enable you to look at other people's chapter. It'll be kind of a sort of a mini social network and a prototype for the bigger ebook. I've been working on that this week. It's not quite up and running. I want to avoid an Obamacare situation with launching that site. I want to make sure it's working 100% right. But look for an email from me on that in the near future. All right, enough about that book. Let's talk about another book, a book entitled The Transhumanist Wager. Zoltan, I thought it would be good just to kind of start out, if you don't mind, give us your brief synopsis. How do you describe the book?
Well, the book is a philosophical novel that is sort of set in a near future scenario, and the main idea behind the book is of one man who absolutely wants to live forever and will do anything and whatever he can to accomplish that goal. And, you know, it's a bit of an epic where it starts off and he's essentially a teenager and then goes all the way to the end of his life. And in between, he goes through all these challenges where he has to kind of fight against the world to actually achieve that.
And has some pretty amazing adventures along the way, and deals with some there's some major conflict in there. I think it's safe to say. Actually, let's go ahead and do this. We're going to go ahead and throw spoilers out as we deem necessary. Because do you think this is true, Zoltan? It's okay if people hear some of the elements of the plot. The real heart of the book is the ideas that it contains. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah, you know, and I encourage you 100% to do spoilers. It's so funny, people always say, oh, spoiler alert. But in the case of my novel, it really doesn't matter as much as perhaps other books, because the essence of the book is really the ideas. And I did not set out to write, the most entertaining book or a book that keeps you up late at night. I set out to write a book where every few pages you have to stop and say, wow, what if that happened? Or what about this idea? Or I haven't seen it that way. So, yes, by all means, throw out spoilers. This is not that kind of book where you can spoil anything.
So with that in mind, can you just tell us what is the transhumanist wager itself? When I first saw the title, I thought, oh, that sounds kind of like Pascal's wager. Is there a parallel there? What is the wager that our hero Jethro Knights makes?
Sure. And yes, there's definitely a correlation to Pascal's wager, which at the, you know, a few centuries ago was one of the most important kind of philosophical arguments of the day, and it sort of at least set in stone a lot of religious ideas for that time period. The transhumanist wager is different in the sense where it no longer needs anything except science and technology to achieve its aims. And the essence of the wager is that we have advanced so far in the 21st century with science and technology that we now owe it to kind of the best in ourselves, to our creative and innovative spirits as a species, to use that science and technology so that we don't have to go through, which I feel is our biggest dilemma, which is death, which is our mortality. And so the transhumanist wager says, if you love your life, then you will do everything in your power to preserve that life. And, you know, given the context of the book, you're going to use all the science and technology that you can to preserve that life. And so essentially it states that you want to do whatever you can, no matter what happens, to preserve a life that most people appreciate and love.
And Jethro demonstrates that repeatedly, and we're going to get into that in some depth a little bit later. But before we do, I've got a kind of a backgrounder question on this one. This is one I imagine you're dealing with quite a bit as you go about talking to people about the book. And congratulations, by the way, on the success of it. It seems to be very well received, and it looks like it's you've picked up quite a readership there.
Thank you so much for that.
So the question is, are you Jethro Knights? And if not, how are you and Jethro different?
I like to say that I'm aspiring to become Jethro Knights. I think it's incredibly difficult to, in the real world, full of all its complexity, to be someone who is always able to make the right decision under the most extreme circumstances. And when I wrote the novel, certainly the first third of the book is very autobiographical, and it covers many of the experiences I've had personally in my life. Of course, the next two-thirds goes completely in a different direction. And I would like to say that I believe in many of his ideas and believe in many of his actions. In fact, perhaps I believe in all of them. Whether I'm actually morally strong enough to stand up to the rigors that he had to face, and whether I would actually be able to make some of those incredibly moral, difficult moral choices that he has made along the way, that is up for question. I would like to, I would want to be strong enough to do that. I realize that brings in incredible controversy. In many ways, he is represents some of the darker sides of what we might call human nature. However, I feel that when you're talking about your mortality, your actual life, all other bets are off, and that sort of starts, that's the very top block at the pyramid. And so I think all other decisions come from there. The one thing I like to say about morality is that, a perfect morality is one that adjusts with the amount of time that you have left to live. And as you have less and less time left to live, you will do more drastic things to achieve that indefinite lifespan. And so anyways, roundabout answer, I'm aspiring to be Jethro Knight. I'm sure I'm going to fall short quite a bit.
Okay. That's interesting. I didn't expect you to claim as close a one-to-one identification with him as you have, at least aspirationally. So that's very interesting. I'm sorry, Stephen, did I step on you there?
Just a little bit, Phil, but I'm going to jump in now.
Let me ask this.
Obviously, there's a lot of controversy within the book. Jethro, is faced with Zoe Bach, I believe, who believes in the afterlife. That's and thinks death is a part of life. And of course, Jethro does not, and believes that he needs to do everything in his power to have an indefinite life, to achieve indefinite life. Let me ask this: do you believe there's room for a middle position, where you hold out the possibility for an afterlife, but think nevertheless death sucks, and therefore I'm going to avoid it as long as possible? Is there room for that?
So there definitely is room for that. And, as much as I am inspired by Jethro Knights, I also see the book as very much a warning that we don't have to go the path he went. As a society, we can, go a path that's peaceful and all achieve it. Because I certainly want everyone to be able to have happiness and achieve whatever, the indefinite lifespans that I think most people would want. Whether there is a possibility of waiting for an afterlife as a middle ground for me. Personally, I could not do that, and that's what would not be allowed in the transhumanist wager. The transhumanist wager, the argument is that, essentially we have no evidence that once people die, there is any type of conscious or any kind of entity that in same form or fashion continues that would be, the same person. Basically, yes, maybe cells and maybe some DNA or whatever like that, but it all merges into something else. It's not, when I die, it's not going to be, Zoltan anymore. It's going to be essentially, physical properties of the earth. So I don't consider that life. I know Zoe Bach has a take on that. However, Jethro does not. So I can't take the middle ground. I can't accept that that would be okay. I realize, there are possibilities in 100, 500 years, 1,000 years, maybe through quantum technology, we might all be brought back. if I could be guaranteed of that, then I would take a kind of approach where maybe there would be a middle ground. But I worry that in the meantime, maybe that won't happen, and I will have given up this gift that you know, I feel is called life.
Now, what do you think about the idea that, in some sense, Zoe is and I know you get this a lot, right? People like Zoe, right? People have issues with Jethro, right? I mean, it's probably the conversation you end up having quite a bit. I know that that was the take that our buddy Julio Brisco had on the London Futures panel with you the other day. But putting aside the fact of whether you agree with one more or, you know, one is more personally likable than the other, is there a case to be made that in some sense she's a bit more courageous than Jethro? Because she's actually, you know what I mean? It's like she's...
Hello, I seem to have lost you guys.
I hear you, Zoltan.
I lost.
Phil, are you still there?
Okay. Yeah, I can take the question over if you guys are still on.
Yeah, I'm here. Zoltan, go ahead if you will.
Okay, great. Yes, Zoe is more courageous than Jethro in some regards. She has more of a sense of believing in faith and believing in fate and believing also just in how destiny unfolds. And the idea, though, behind that is that, you know, one person's sense of fate and destiny is not necessarily based on any kind of reason. It's just sort of based on an emotional feeling, this is going to be okay no matter what happens. And that does take a large amount of courage. I just don't know if Thor doesn't believe in it, if it's really a matter of courage. I think what I tend to think it more of is it's just gone on, it's crossed over from the line of reason to something more mystical. And but, you know, a lot of times being mystical, actually, for especially for a very rational-minded person, takes a huge amount of courage. So, you know, I'm just not sure really courage is the word that Jethro really aspires to. He's not really afraid of things anyways. He just simply sees things as perhaps a machine would, very black and white.
Okay, fair enough.
There's a related question here. In visiting with Aubrey de Grey a couple of years back, Aubrey mentioned how, you know, those who want to achieve indefinite life would become risk averse. I mean, would Jethro Knight necessarily take a solo trip around the world in a boat? Would he do some of the things that you've done that are, you know, are physically dangerous if he's wanting to achieve indefinite life? And would that lead to a poorer life than others, including yourself, have led?
Sure, and it's an excellent question. I get to ask this question a lot. In fact, sometimes people think I'm just a walking contradiction because I still, you know, do dangerous things, ride my Harley Davidson and whatnot. And the thing here is that part of the built into the transhumanist wager in itself, in the actual concept, is the love and the appreciation of life. Without that, there's no need to make a transhumanist wager because non-existence is not so bad compared to a life that's either just mediocre or maybe just, you know, you're unconcerned with it. But Jethro is very much in love with life. He really wants to leave every stone. I mean, he really wants to turn over every stone and discover. His biggest, you know, I think, goal in life is really to ask all these questions. What can I do? How can I become this? You know, where am I going next? And I think that's a very deep-seated love and appreciation of life that he has. I feel that same thing, regardless what I do, you know, in my day-to-day experiences. And to take that away, I might actually take away the part that wants to fulfill the transhumanist wager. So there is something there that seems to contradict itself, but it's also very necessary to have a love and appreciation of life, to want to go the full distance, to want to do anything that you might have to do to achieve your own indefinite lifespan. And these are part of the reasons that Jethro actually goes and does some of these crazy things, sailing and goes to conflict zones and whatnot, is because he knows all along he's sort of justifying his own reasons for wanting to live and accomplish the transhumanist wager. And honestly, I feel the exact same thing with me. I think if you take away too much of my heart or too much of the best, the spirit in me, the best of it, I may not have such a strong drive for transhumanism or some of the other goals I have of indefinite lifespan.
Yeah.
Okay, so I call the next two sections of the show things I agree with Jethro about and things I disagree with Jethro about. So, Stephen, you can you can throw in on both lists. But the things that I find myself in absolute agreement with Jethro Knights about is pretty basic stuff that we talk about on this program all the time. One, that human enhancement, that life extension, that the singularity, that this combination of accelerating change that we talk about in the singularitarian, the transhumanist community, this represents the next step in human evolution. That it's a good thing, and we absolutely should accelerate progress towards those things. Those are good goals to go after, and we should be working on them. I also agree with Jethro that being alive is a very good thing. And Stephen, I think you had one that tactically that you liked about what Jethro does.
Phil, you're talking about.
We were talking about right before the show the fact that they use the C-STED was the.
We could spend a whole show talking just about the seasteading aspects. I mean, that's a real movement. You know, there's New York Magazine published something a couple of weeks ago about basically a group in Silicon Valley that are thinking about these things or actively pursuing it. And we see things like these Google barges that we don't really know too much about, but it appears that people are at least contemplating the possibility of seasteading in the real world.
So my question to you, Zoltan, is that's the basic list. I bet everybody says they agree with Jethro on that part. Is that right? Or do you get much pushback as you're talking to people about this book on any of the stuff that I just mentioned, or do people pretty much seem to be on board with it?
Well, so a lot of people are in utter disagreement with the book, and a lot of people dislike Jethro right off the bat, and a lot of people like Zoe, you know, not surprisingly. But I think what I've been really happy about with the book is even people that really dislike Jethro find quite a lot of the story worthwhile taking in and contemplating. Like I said, the book can be taken as a work of inspiration or as a warning. And I really don't mind how people take it. I just think it's great that it's making people think. But certainly, some of the most extreme elements of Jethro are very disliked. The fact that he is, to a certain extent, defends the omnipotent or the concept that somebody wants to acquire all power, which is very Nietzschean. And that the fact that he is willing to, perhaps start wars and fight people and stuff like that to accomplish his goals sounds very, totalitarian and all these other things. And the book's been compared into so many historical figures, Stalin and Hitler and all these other things. That said, I think a lot of people actually are finding many parts of Jethro that they agree with. And I think what upsets a lot of people is that they want to agree with him entirely, but they know they can't. And at the end of the book, there's a long passage where I talk about my concept of baggage culture, where we have been trained as individuals from, I have a 3-year-old and I all day long teach her, be nice to the other kids in school, do this, brush your teeth. We have been programmed in many ways to follow the cultural mores of our time and of our society and of our heritage and things like that. And while that has worked for, civilization as a whole, at the point how fast technology and science is growing, I'm no longer sure that our culture is going to be able to keep up with the morals and the ethics that may be required to handle the technology that's going to come in the later half of the 21st century. In fact, one of the things I've been trying to tell people is that the transhumanist wager is a bridge. It's not necessarily a book that says where morality needs to be exactly today. It's a book that says if artificial intelligence or AGI or something like that is going to be here in 10 or 15 years, what will their moral systems be like? In fact, Jethro, towards the end of the book, starts writing the morality of the machine and other essays like that, because he becomes sort of more and more obsessed with how will a machine actually think, how will artificial intelligence think, and not in terms of the decisions it makes, but in terms of the morals it uses. And I feel with technology increasing so quickly, we're going to need a new set of morals. So the Judeo-Christian framework that most Americans have is just simply not going to deal with some of the crazy things that are going to be happening, including uploading or including cyborgs, bionics, the hive mind, some of these concepts that are coming. I think a stronger moral system is going to be necessary. And that's one of the reasons why I devised Jethro to be as he is. He's a bridge to understanding how much further I think our society and our species must develop in a moral sense to be able to contend with all this coming change, which is coming a lot quicker than most people realize, and is probably going to be much more dramatic on society than most people realize.
All right, and we'll get into all that a little bit more deeply under things I disagree with with Jethro about. But I think that the point is very well made, that it's hard to disagree with somebody loving life. You know what I mean? When you start with that premise, when you look at Jethro and say this guy thinks life is of value, he sees his own life as being of value, and you know the comparison keeps being made to John Galt, but in that sense he's a lot like Howard Rourke from The Fountainhead, who's a man who's just very much in love with life and wants to go out and do incredible things. And that side of a character is extremely appealing, I think, to everybody. It's hard for me to imagine, unless you're, you know, kind of not up on life yourself, how a character who feels that way could be other than appealing. But I think it's possible that a love of life can take people in a lot of different directions. And let's talk a little bit about some of the things I disagree with Jethro about. For example, I really love life, too. I do. I like being alive, and I think the idea of preserving and protecting that indefinitely is an outstanding idea, one that I take very seriously. But no matter how strongly I feel about that, I wouldn't kill the woman I love 1,000 times over to ensure my continued existence. You know, I just that idea is so repugnant to me, and it's presented, it seems to me, it's the impression I get of Jethro is that he feels that to take any other position is to lack philosophical integrity. To me, it seems like it's not so much philosophical integrity as it is some kind of ideological purity, and in fact, I think you could read that section of the book and go, or maybe it's just more of a kind of a pathological obsession at that point, right? That we've gone outside of what's healthy or good, and it becomes not a strength because he's so moral and pure, but a kind of a weakness because not only does it take his good intentions to an absurd end, but it seems to kind of destroy his credibility. What do you think of that? I'll let you just respond to my take.
Sure. Well, I mean, you've picked out the most difficult line in the book, killing one's wife 1,000 times, because and I struggled with that, and I talked endlessly with my own wife about it, who I love very much. And again, this I tried to write something that I thought represented the very most powerful thought that I could under all the circumstances. It was not necessarily a thought that's designed to be confined by what we consider culture, families, planet Earth. It's a thought that's supposed to be, I want to be the most powerful, entity in the universe, and that is the goal. And this is the kind of thing that he would agree to. And again, it's incredibly difficult because could I do that? No. This is, I have a wonderful life. I could not do that. However, thinking about philosophy, and you're talking about trying to establish a framework, a new moral system that at least should be examined. Not necessarily I'm saying that this is the way the world needs to follow it, but it should be talked about and it should be examined. These are the kind of things that I put out there so that we could have this discussion and say, well, how far would one actually go to achieve a goal that they want? You're right, it is completely obsessive. It's perhaps totally pathological. However, it might take that kind of entity to evolve through the billions and billions of years. And I know we're just speaking here in 2013 and it's November or something like that. But, you know, taking history and civilization as a whole, perhaps there will be life forms in the 2,000, 3,000 years that will have absolutely, will kind of laugh at this type of moral discussion, what we call good and what we call bad. This is what I talk about baggage culture. We've been trained to think that that kind of saying, that kind of thing is bad. But then perhaps an artificial intelligence that will be a billion times smarter than us may not even recognize such a value play in that.
Right. Or it might be a lot nicer than us, too, right? I mean, isn't that the other possibility, that it might be inconceivably nicer than we are rather than harsher than we are? I mean, is it less useful to think of it in those terms?
Yeah, you know, let me throw in on this. You know, it seems like as people have moved forward morally, you know, our golden rule has evolved from, you know, do unto others as you know, and others being just a member of this little tribe, to you know, and then others, you know, do unto others as you'd have done to you. That would, you know, then it was not just this tribe, but other, you know, other people outside the tribe, and then eventually people of other races, and then, you know, others, you know, the other is always growing, and you know, to include even higher animals now, with, you know, some people feel that way. Couldn't it be that we just continue to broaden that, and like, you know, just become nicer over time instead of instead of going the other way?
Absolutely. And again, in this sense, you know, if I could be guaranteed of something like that, then I would 100% consider that, and you could rest assured that, you know, again, I've spent, you know, most of my life doing humanitarian work, wildlife work, really things that nice people do. And I, you know, and when I take my daughter to school and stuff like that, you know, I'm just the normal guy who drops her off at the, you know, at preschool. The problem, though, that I have, at least from a philosophical point, I find it incredibly difficult to think that after so many years of evolution, we are actually evolving into being nicer entities. I actually think we have just sort of evolved as society is getting prepared to change itself into something else. I don't know, when you talk about what actually motivates evolution, what motivates these things, in general, it's a very unconscious process that is just simply very black and white, sort of like my book. I think as computers, and as artificial intelligence and stuff like that slowly starts to be integrated into our brains, we will have less and less feelings of this idea of being nice and being good, and more this idea of what is the core issue at hand. Well, for most entities, the very core issue at hand is survival, and this goes back to the very first opening words of my novel, The Three Laws. And, you know, I sort of believe in those three laws on a kind of quintessential level. There's really no defying them. And if you take those three laws seriously, you realize that unless you can be guaranteed of, you know, accomplishing the transhumanist wager through everyone being nice and sharing and that kind of stuff, you're still going to be left with the problem that you actually are subject to some type of danger, some type of insecurity, something that can take everything away from you in an instant, or at least quickly. That's why I think I presented this novel to say, well, there is an alternative. There is a moral system where you actually seek to accomplish the gaining, you know, this ultimate power or the search for it. And I do fundamentally believe that evolution developed that way, and that it's very hard to take that out of us. I know there's a lot of other ideas like the hedonistic imperative and stuff like that actually give certain outs to the philosophy in my book. However, I have arguments against all of them on why I don't think they would necessarily work, why I think you're still going to end up with one entity that wants everything, and if he's strong enough, he or she is going to take it. He or she, it could be a computer.
When you talk about evolution in those terms, I wonder, are you familiar with Matt Ridley, The Rational Optimist, that book?
You know, I'm brief. I know him slightly. Certainly couldn't quote any of his works at the moment.
Okay, so one of the ideas that Matt talks about in that book, and his background is actually in evolutionary biology, so he extrapolates from that to talk about why things might get better and why a lot of the negativity that people have about the future is maybe misplaced. But one of the things he talks about in evolution is the incredible shift that occurred in our evolution as a species when we started trading with each other. And it's this new paradigm that emerges that's very different from, at least in terms of scale, from what occurs within any other species. Because we figured out this way that party A can get what they want, party B can get what they want, and actually, you know, through the exchange, both parties get enriched. So we developed this means of interacting with each other that wasn't zero sum, that was something other than I get all the marbles and you lose. Evolution has become something as much for us as a species, at least as a civilization, as much cooperative as it is competitive, where we actually have, you know, yes, still the existent, you know, the fact that the weak are going to die out, but you also have some of the weak kind of becoming stronger over time, you know, and relatively speaking, as the species evolves, all of the members, even the weakest members, are stronger than the ones who came before, because that's what technology enables. If only through the economic power that we have, we're more powerful in many ways than the our ancestors were. If you look at evolution that way, it seems to me that it does not imply the emergence of a single omnipotent member of the species. Evolution is interested in making the species better, not about landing one individual member of the species on top of the heap. Although that behavior has existed, it seems that that other behaviors have come along and are in competition with that. But I don't hear much of that coming from Jethro. He doesn't seem to be interested in anything other than the most competitive dog-eat-dog, you know, kill-or-be-killed view of evolution. Is it because that other stuff isn't helpful to getting you to live forever, or do you you don't think that that branch of studying evolution is necessarily valid?
So, well, there's two things there. I'm just not sure that what you said sounds great. It's utopian, and if I could be guaranteed of that, or if Jethro could be guaranteed of that, just like the quantum, you know, technology somehow being brought back into the you know, far in the future, someone bringing you back to being alive from after you've been dead, that would be great. Then I think all my bets on my philosophy would be off. But the real problem at hand is that the thing you're talking about is quite nebulous. It sounds good. You're right. We are improving. Things are getting better. But it doesn't actually help Jethro in the moment that he has. It actually doesn't help me that much because, for example, my father had his first heart attack at 51. I just turned 40. And I have, you know, a very limited amount of time left to try to do something where I can actually continue this life that I love. The other thing I want to say is, so, you know, while I think what you're saying is great, and like I said, I do support things that make society just better and people happy. I just, you know, in general, I really do like living on a nice street filled with trees and having kids go to school. I mean, I'm a pretty nice guy, but on the other hand, I realize that dying is sort of an unacceptable proposition at this moment. And I tend to think the way evolution works is not as a whole. You're looking at it sort of from a whole perspective. I think what happens is there are outsiders or there are people that come in and completely disrupt systems. And in this book, Jethro is that one disruption. He's the one person that no one really accounted for, and then all of a sudden he's able to create this movement that goes forward. We've had you know, similar things in history by characters, and real-life characters that have done that and made huge movements happen. It just this time, it might be very different when you bring in so much technology and so much science, especially in the realm of artificial intelligence, when you can actually get something that could become far more intelligent and powerful than the human entity. It really could change the scales of something if one or two or a whole group of people just want to take off in that direction. And so this is one of the reasons why I, you know, again, I put forth this philosophy is to try to counterbalance those kind of things happening as well, even though Jethro is the prime example of that type of mutation, what you might say, happening where a single entity decides he wants it all.
Yeah, I was just thinking the word mutation, kind of like in the Foundation series, the mule, right? This unexpected sport, this new creature that appears and is not on the map, right? Completely shakes everything up. Okay, I can see that. Let's talk about the biggest difference I have with Jethro. I'm sorry, Stephen, do you have some points of disagreement that you want to bring out with Jethro? I don't mean to dominate.
I actually have a point of agreement.
Hey, we've already done those.
I know, but come on.
Go ahead.
Give me a chance, man.
Oh, yeah, okay, go ahead.
Okay. Talking just a little bit about seasteading, I think that it's an important thing for a revolutionary at this point to be able to have a clean slate somewhere to write on, you know. I thought it was interesting that I'm gonna butcher this name, but I think it's Balaji Srinivasan. He's the co-founder of the genetics company Council. He spoke about seasteading, and he said the best part about seasteading is that the people who think that this is weird, the people who sneer at it, won't follow you there. They will not be there to mess up your experiment, and so I think that this is a real movement that could potentially we could potentially live to see. So
yeah,
I find myself in agreement with you know, at least tactically, that if you're going to do something, you know, you're going to experiment, you really need to have a new place to do it in. So.
Sure, and let me just say also, Stephen, that I'm an ambassador actually at the Seasteading Institute, and
okay.
these are not ideas anymore. We have projects going on where people are actually gathering the money right now to start building this stuff, and I fully believe that within 3 to 5 years we will have people start construction on some of these smaller projects to test out this, and I'm very hopeful that in 10 or 20 years we will have 5, 10, maybe even 20 platforms out there of people doing exactly this. They're trying to get away from the regulations that the governments or that the religious people or whatever, you know, just present problems and just be able to do the kind of experimentation that they need to do, you know, sort of behind closed doors and on their own terms. And I fully encourage that. I actually think it's probably better to have people out in the ocean, because if something goes wrong, it's going to certainly affect the world less. If something explodes or some kind of virus gets out or whatnot. And in that way, seasteading is also excellent. But it's also excellent because, it gives the scientists a chance to be away from the kind of pressures that normal society would bring upon, radical experimentation and research. And I couldn't be excited enough just to become an ambassador recently for the Seasteading Institute.
Well, that's very cool. We've had Patrick Friedman on the show. We've had Max Marty on talking about seasteading. It's great to hear that there's progress being made on that. Nothing as ambitious or even within an order of magnitude or two of transhumania, though, on the being planned currently, is there?
No, nothing like that. In fact, the stuff going on now is quite small, but that's why they're able to get investors on board and stuff like that, because it is projects that people believe will be fulfilled and will be accomplished, and it'll be great to then, you know, send out 10 people and say, well, how does this society work out here? Did you get the experimentation done and stuff like that? So I'm excited by the project they have. I think they're going to work out, and I think one thing's for sure, it's going to just lead to bigger ones and bigger ones until finally there's going to be a full-scale Transhumania. It may not be called Transhumania, of course, but we are all going to go there and just hopefully be amazed probably in, I'm hoping, less than 15 to 25 years, I think there'll be a massive floating platform out there.
I hope there are a number of good-sized ones, big enough to be viable in terms of there's actually some kind of social interaction going on there. One of the things Patrick talks about that's important about Seasteads is there are these little labs. They let you try things out. You can try different economic models out, try different political systems out that would be really hard to implement experimentally on a full-blown nation state, but you can try it out with a Seastead. So get a few dozen of those out there running, and you might come up with some real breakthroughs for how to work the world better.
Oh, yeah, 100%. And that, it should just be just more experimentation. It'd be great to see that. I mean, can you imagine reality TV shows following all the scientists around and just working on things? I mean, it would actually be incredibly interesting to watch. I don't even have a TV in the house, but I think maybe I'd want to watch it.
Absolutely. So you work for the National Geographic Channel and all those other, you've done all that other TV and you don't have a TV in your house.
Yeah. I'm not the biggest TV fan. And I do most of my stuff either from the iPad or the computer at this point, in DVDs and stuff like that. So
absolutely, fair enough. Well, I don't think Jethro had a TV either, so I think we've identified another common thread. All right, so I've got another point of disagreement with Jethro, and I'm skip a couple. I'm going to go to my big one here.
Okay, great.
Did we lose you again, Phil?
I've lost him. Yeah, again.
Yeah, I'm not. He's still gathering his thoughts about what a disagreement. While we're waiting on Phil to come back on, I wanted to ask this. You had said that every person going forward is going to face a transhumanist wager. Could you explain why? Why are we all going to have a transhumanist wager? A bet that will have to be made.
Sure, and that's an excellent question, because I think what's going to likely happen is here in the next 10, 20, 30 years, everyone is going to make more and more choices to integrate technology into their lives, and ultimately we're going to become entities that rely entirely on that. And there's going to naturally be people that decide, wait, this is way too much. And what's going to happen is those people that decide it's either way too much or it conflicts with too much of their religious beliefs. I mean, for example, as soon as you find a way to solve mortality, you have essentially created the biggest conflict in all religious history. Most religions are based on the idea that there is an afterlife. If you act good, you get to go there. If you take away the necessity of that, then all of a sudden there will be massive kind of a upheaval in terms of how religious people deal with that. So, in fact, that's part of why my book is built on basically that controversy. And given the fact that 90-95% of the world is quite religious, you're going to have problems like that. But ultimately, I think that's where the transhumanist wager comes in, is everyone is going to sort of realize that, wow, technology really is progressing so quickly, I need to make a choice. Do I support integrating all this technology into my being, into my brain, whatever happens in 20, 30, 40 years, or do I just remain a normal human being, go through a mortal life, die, maybe have children? And that's going to cause a division. There's no question about it. There will be a division that will occur because of that. And, I don't know what the population numbers will be, but even if, it's a quarter versus three quarters, 2 billion versus 6 billion or something like that, there's going to be haves and have-nots, and it's going to cut at the very core of what civilization, society sort of is and stands for, and I think that's going to cause great conflict. And this is what I mean when I say everyone faces a transhumanist wager, is every single person will have to make this decision. How far do they take the technology and science that is now available to them? And if they don't take it all the way, what is the outcome going to be of that?
It's not just a religious upheaval, I wouldn't think. It's, societal upheaval, secular societal upheaval, because our whole culture is built around
you know, you're young, you're educated while you're young, you go to college perhaps, you get a job, you work for a period of years, you retire, you die. You know, and, you know, get married and have kids maybe in the interim, but, you know, there's a certain pattern to how people live their lives. If, you know, if we have indefinite youth, then that sort of is that is thrown out as well, isn't it?
Yeah, no, and you're 100% right. I created the religious conflict because that's the most obvious one. And I generally thought that most secular people or whatever would kind of say, yeah, you know, transhumanism, technology, all this is kind of weird, but in the end of the day, it probably is the best thing to do. I kind of felt like it would be easier transition if the religious picture was out of it. But you're 100% right. What's going to happen is the entire fabric of society will collapse. As I explain, you know, a little bit in the book, I'm not sure if marriage will exist. I'm not sure if sexuality will exist. I'm not sure that it will be worth having children or having kind of offspring in any terms like that. I think most of the social standards will be challenged. And that is inevitably going to create huge amounts of hostility, especially as so much of our social standards are tied to economics. You know, if you, for example, take marriage out of the picture or something like that, well, how does that affect the tax system? How does that affect all the other things that have been built upon these pillars of, you know, of society and social conditioning? So clearly there's going to be massive amounts of change. And this is why a lot of my book centers around, you know, the riots and in the street, because I do believe in the next 5 to 10 years, you're going to see this more and more happening in Congress and more happening in the media, that conventions will be challenged because of science and technology. And the challenging part will come, you know, what they're going to result in is people, I think, like myself, saying, well, we want to take this further because we want to have these indefinite lifespans. We want to have these bionic arms. We want to have the ability to be a faster runner than a horse. We want to have all the transhuman abilities that can come to us. And we're not going to stop until we achieve them just because a government or a religious organization or even a secular organization says, hey, that's not the best for society. You know, I think from an evolutionary perspective, we have the right to all that. As a human being, I want the right to that, and I believe I have it. And so I'm going to pursue that, you know, with all my heart. And I think that's indubitably going to create a huge amount of strain on society and on civilization as we know it.
Okay, well, let's keeping in that vein. Let me be a pure transhumanist here for a minute and ask this question. Isn't the whole revolution idea kind of a dying paradigm, kind of a dead paradigm? You know, when I was born, there were about 3 billion people on the planet. And as of last week, there are nearly 3 billion people on the Internet. Okay? So there's a revolution for you, right? Okay? And there were no manifestos. There were no shots fired. There were no demagogues making a grab for absolute power, you know, unless you want to count Bill Gates or Larry Ellison or somebody like that. But, you know, the point is, it seems that technology and markets and social structures are how revolutionary change really truly occurs today. We've passed that, you know, political revolution paradigm. We've left it in the past. And to talk about it in those terms, it seems to me that we're kind of setting the clock back.
Yeah. You know, so Phil, you have very good points because, in fact, I talk with people about this all the time. I really firmly believe that technology has significantly helped out standards of life for, you know, virtually every person on the planet, and certainly is looking to increase the standards of life, and that is a wonderful thing. There is a chance, and I'm hopeful that this will occur, that we can go through these enormous changes without any kind of massive disruption to the system, meaning the system of society and of civilization, that perhaps religion, as Giulio Prisco would have it, would shift, slowly evolve to incorporate science and technology, and that other things would just back off some of the more fervent beliefs and say, well, we're going to, we're going to now take in these ideas that we once thought were so hostile to us. If such a thing was to happen, if, you know, religious people and sort of governments and stuff like that were able to open their minds a little bit more and say, well, let's just all work together. And I do believe that we could 100% go through all these changes and become truly transhuman entities, explore all the planets and live in peace. And I'm a big fan of using technology, even if it means a little bit of Big Brother, you know, stuff in it, to work and protect everyone. I'm hoping that that will be the case, that we will all be able to maintain as many freedoms as possible and increase the safety and longevity of every single person on the planet. In fact, that's the third law of my book, you know, the three laws of transhumanism, that you need to protect any value that you can. And that means every single thing on the planet. I'm entirely for that. Now, whether that's possible kind of goes back to our earlier conversation. This is a very challenging thing to speculate on. It's so big and enormous. I'm not 100% sure.
Okay, fair enough. That's actually, the honest answer, right? I don't know for sure, exactly. That's kind of where we all are with this, isn't it? When I think about the sweep of what's coming, and, well, by definition, when we talk about the singularity, we're talking about the point beyond which we really can't make predictions, where our models break down. But it does come down to this issue of what's going to break down first, and how quickly can things get better? How quickly can we make things happen in the direction that we want them to go? Stephen, I know I've just been totally overbearing tonight. You probably have one last question you'd like to throw Zoltan's way.
No. Phil, you've dropped out a couple of times. We had to.
I know. I have to keep calling back in. Are you sure you're not doing that? I think you are.
I don't. No. I promise I'm not. Actually, you know, I would say that one thing that seems like is already happening is that the work model is beginning to fail.
Right.
We're seeing that, you know, it used to be that as new technology was brought in, it just created higher level jobs. It seems like that's not happening anymore, and that that we may see slowly see the work model erode as jobs are taken over by various computers or AIs or whatever, and never return to humanity. We may be beginning to see some of these revolutions taking place right there. That may be the beginning of it. What do you think, Zoltan? Do you think that may be the beginning of what we're looking at?
Sure. You know, I got to say that is such a fascinating topic, and we could probably talk hours on this. It's great because it really is happening, and you're seeing it again and again. As you know, first it was job losses over to Asia and stuff like that from the United States, but now it's actually, you know, just the automation of everything happening, and a lot of people are sort of left, well, what do we actually do? That said, I'm hopeful that, and this is where I would hope scientists, governments, researchers would come in and say, well, there must be things that people can do and train for new stuff that can actually help so that everyone has a job, or at least if not everyone has a job, everyone is able to have enough food and the housing that they need and stuff like that so they don't cause revolutions. And that's the main problem here, is that if you have too many people out of work, everything will break down. You're right, these models are breaking down. And I think, you know, the conversation like we're having now is perhaps the very best thing for it, because it gets us thinking, well, what is the new model? What's the new paradigm that we need to discover so that all this can work out, so that we actually don't have revolutions? Revolutions are perhaps, as I've talked about in my book, that some of the thing you want least for a transhuman future is some kind of cataclysmic event to happen to the planet, or too many revolutions where all the economics have to get sunk into the worst thing in the world, which is, into bombs and things like that, as opposed to into science. So I'm all about finding, I'm all about trying to find ways and new models that will keep everyone happy and looking towards the future rather than breakdowns. And, you know, I just want to point out that despite some of the things I've said on the show, it should be noted that Jethro, and just as well as myself, never wanted to go down the path of the book, you know, The Transhumanist Wager. That is just the events that unfolded because of certain types of scenarios. I think if you had given, you know, Jethro his wish, he would have had a family with Zoe. He would have been working for his transhuman organization, transhuman citizen, and, you know, making strides and steps forward like that. Unfortunately, what I feel is when, as you said, point out, when the models start failing and we really do have breakdown society and ultimately that leads to revolution, these are some of the things that can actually take place. And so I'm very hopeful that in this sense, people, you know, will read the book and just and understand that there's a warning to be listened to as well. And, you know, we do need to find ways so that the world can move forward, continue on its excellent progress of science and you know, innovating technology so that we can all benefit, so that we don't have to go through major revolutions and the breakdown just to get to the singularity.
Well, you know what? We're going to have to let that be the last word. Unfortunately, we are completely out of time. I can't believe how fast the time has gone by. It's a testament to what an interesting discussion this is and what a great guest
Absolutely. You
are, Dalton. Thank you so much for being with us this evening, and we wish you all the best of success. I presume there will be more books coming.
Yes. First, let me just say thank you so much, Stephen and Phil, for having me on the show. It was really fun. You're right. It was too short. I'm sorry about that. And, yes, there are more things coming for sure. I'm actively working on them as we are going through this radio show. So thank you so much for having me on the show. It's been really great.
Well, we look forward to we'll definitely having you back somewhere down the road, and we'll pick this conversation up. Stephen, what's our music this evening?
Very fun hour, Phil. The music tonight is Harmony by Jeremy Jones Bonner.
Jeremy Jones Bonner playing Harmony. All right, thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Thanks once again to our guest, Zoltan Istvan, for being with us this evening. Thank all of you for being with us tonight, those of you listening live, those of you listening via MP3. Thanks for being part of The World Transformed. We will be on an hour late next week, but back at the regular time the following week, and we're going to be trying out a new format then. I'll be putting some information up on the blog, so be looking for that. And until next time, live to see it.